ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
We've all heard of that phrase, dying of a broken heart, but what does the science actually say about that? I mean, can you die of a broken heart? Can grieving really have a physical effect on the body? Joining us for the latest in science news on this and other important matters, Rod Lamberts, Deputy Director of the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science. Rob, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
How are you, Phil?
Not bad. This study was from the University of Arizona in the US.
Mm.
Tell us about it.
It's an interesting one. Well, this is one of these classics, I think, where it's very easy to go, well, duh, people after the death of a loved one, for example, there are epidemiological studies that demonstrate they often will die quite frequently. In fact, all people have become quite unwell after the death of a very close loved one, particularly older couples. So we hear this a lot. But the studies don't often really try and determine cause. They just sort of notice that this happened. So this one is a bit different because it looked at people within a year of the loss of a close loved one, 59 people. And they decided they'd sort of try and do what I think is the equivalent of, you know, a stress test. After you've had a heart attack, they put you on treadmills and strap you to machines and push your heart hard to see how well it works. In this instance, they called it like an emotional stress test. So they talked to people in this study for 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They asked them to share a moment when they felt very alone after the death of their loved one. And they measured blood pressure. Pretty straightforward, really.
Mm-hmm.
And they found there was definitely an effect. So they call it, this grief recall, as they call it, the systolic, so the top number of your blood pressure, the one that we want to be, the magical 120 on average, it would go up after this brief consideration talking about the death of a loved one. It would go up on average by 20 points, or 21 points, in fact, which is a lot. And that's, in fact, I'd say it's roughly equivalent to doing a moderate level of exercise.
Yes, it was. It'd go from 120 to 140.
Yeah, for example, yeah.
For example, yeah.
Yeah, and that's on average. So, I mean, this is, for starters, quite a significant rise, but then that's just on average. So the people at the more extreme ends and the people who reported greater amounts of grief would have been higher than this. So this is not nothing. This is definitely not nothing. And it's really demonstrating a very clear link, at least an initial clear link, between this reminiscing about loss or experiencing loss and cardiovascular effects. So That matters.
Yes, as you say, the researchers carried out this process called grief recall on the study participants. So they basically asked them to go back in there. Did they? Yeah.
And look, like I say, they made sure there were people who were within a year of the loss of a close loved one. So they didn't, you know, ask you to do this 20 years later or something. And the person, of course, had to be close to them.
Mm.
Just the recall of it. I mean, I suppose the suspicion is, of course, if you are in this close grief period after the death of the loved one, you would be recalling grief moments regularly and often not at your own, not deliberately.
Mm.
So imagine doing this a lot. If there's an average increase of 20, 21 points on your systolic blood pressure, that over a period of time could be quite damaging.
Yeah, I wonder what you do with this. I mean, because in essence, it's saying people feel grief and loss very deeply, which, yeah, we do. We do. I mean, you can't really treat something like this, though, can you? Or can you? I mean, is that what there is? I mean, maybe there's no takeaway from this, but
I think, the takeaway, the most sort of significant one for me is, I suppose, when someone's in this position, don't just give them tea and sympathy. Don't just have a chat. Maybe you actually should do medical checks about things like blood pressure, et cetera. Because, I mean, you can medicate for high blood pressure, but you could also encourage, I don't know, activity or activities that calm you down, that lower your blood pressure in ways that matter. Because I think that's the biggest takeaway, is actually keep an eye on it with people in this position.
Hmm.
Don't just kind of assume, well, it's going to be icky. Actually keep an eye on it and see if you should intervene in some way if possible.
Yeah, so in other words, yes, the effects are measurable in your body. They're not just a sea of grief in your head. The ocean is flowing everywhere in the body.
Yeah. And so it's that classic, you know, this isn't just in the mind. And
no.
I mean, that just in the mind comment really doesn't work anyway, because something in the mind exists and it can have strong effects. But this adds another layer to that, where you can get external measurable indicators of well-being.
Very interesting. All right, on to other news, Rod. This involves apes and children and the idea of reward.
Well,
children are up for rewards, I suppose. I mean, adults. I mean, I don't know about apes. I haven't spent much time around them. Well, you know, not really. I could make some assessments, but you know what I mean.
I don't know, snide comments about co-workers notwithstanding, I understand. this one's about, I suppose, comparing, ultimately, it's billed as, do we always want to open the proverbial Pandora's box? Are we always tempted to open the thing? We don't know what's in there, but we must find out, and then it could lead to terrible things. I mean, and I think that's a slightly misleading headline. This is about comparing curiosity between humans and great apes, or children, 3 to 5 year olds in this instance. But they're kind of curious. They say, look, humans are super curious critters, and the authors even argue maybe the most curious of all animals, which is an interesting statement to begin with, I think. Are we? I'm not sure.
What, humans?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
I don't know. When I look at a puppy at play, I think they're pretty curious. But look, this is not the science.
Why, they're not. They're curious about the same thing. I mean, for it, I don't know.
That's true.
I mean, a friend of mine had a dog with a ball, you know, that just used to go nuts about a ball. But he would do the same thing. I pick it up, I throw it away. I mean, I would throw it away, pick it up and come back again and again and again, and never tired of it. And I was thinking, I don't know, if you're curious, wouldn't you think, is there something else we could do?
Is there more to this life?
Is there more to this life than this? And do you do anything else other than just chuck the ball?
Well, maybe that should be the next study, but beyond chimps, or rather what they did. So they did it. The experiment was basically to check this out. You know, are our close cousins, great apes, similarly curious? And so the comparison was between 3 to 5 year old children and then a mixture of adult chimps, gorillas, bonobos, and orangutans. So quite a mix.
Yeah.
That people and apes are interested in rewards. In the children's case, they use stickers. And in the apes' case, it was food. It was grape halves. Mm-hmm. So that was the incentive, I suppose, or the interest grabber for both participants, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is that there was quite a few little sub-experiments, and the details are really not great radio. But the bottom line was two plastic cups were featured in the experiments that really got the eyes raised. One was transparent, one was opaque. Mm-hmm. The opaque ones could be multiple different colors and things, but they were definitely, you couldn't see what was inside. If you put some grape halves or stickers under them and you turn them upside down, you couldn't see through the opaque one. And what they basically did was see what happened when once apes were primed with pre-experiments to think about looking under the cups and imagining there might be some reward associated with it. There was an elaborate amount of pre-testing and pre-training, in a sense, to get them used to the idea at all. Mm-hmm. They then went, okay, let's compare what happens when we put one cup, an opaque cup and a transparent cup down, and the transparent cup had one grape or one or two stickers, and the opaque cup had more. In the case of the apes, it was like three grape halves rather than one. And they basically, under different conditions, said, okay, let's see what they choose. And the bottom line was, when they were first presented with two cups, just one opaque and one see-through, more than 75% of children would choose the opaque cup. They choose the cup in which they didn't know what was underneath. So they could see a definite reward through the clear one, but they'd go, let's check out the Pandora's box.
They'll later go on to become online gamblers because they're always wanting to know what the win's going to be.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but it's got to be good. And so this was interesting. So more than 75% of children would do this under different conditions. Mm. But with the apes, to begin with, only 24%, so a quarter, so way less than children, would go for the one that they couldn't see.
Oh, okay.
So immediately without any other real priming, they didn't do anything. Once both children and apes realized that there could be reward at all, better yet, potentially a better one under the, you know, in Pandora's box, so to speak.
Yeah.
Then it all went up. So in many trials after that, 88-ish% of both apes and kids chose the opaque one. So before they knew it was likely there could be something under there, kids were still likely to go and check it out, more curious to know what was in the cup they couldn't see. Apes, not so much.
Okay, interesting.
I think it is. Although, I mean, I should note, the experimenters didn't say this, but these were, of course, all apes in captivity. So I do wonder if their risk aversion or their level of curiosity is tempered by that positively or negatively. I don't know.
Yeah.
But maybe that has an effect. I think the children were free range, so, you know, we can't compare that way.
Oh, dear. Finally, Rob said, there is some good news in relation to the treatment of chronic myeloid leukemia.
Well, this is good. It's not so much about the treatment, but it's more about targeting existing treatments. And this is where, you know, AI meets medical science, et cetera, or at least machine learning, which is a subset of AI, I've been told convincingly by a number of websites. So with chronic myeloid leukemia, CML, there's a genetic mutation switches on an enzyme. And this enzyme basically wreaks havoc, causes aggressive leukemic cells to wander through the body. Mm-hmm. Eventually, normal blood production stops. It's terrible. It's a terrible disease. There's a standard treatment for this, which is an inhibitor. So it inhibits a particular enzyme that gets inappropriately created. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. And for some people, it works super well, and they go on to have even normal lifespan. So they just live a normal life. But for others, not so well. And in some cases, it doesn't work at all. And they go on to have what they call a blast crisis, which is not great. That's resistant to standard therapies. It's really quite horrible. And the only treatment is bone marrow transplant. So that's not new. They know this.
Yep.
But the most effective time to do these transplants is early in the disease stages. So you don't want to be mucking around with other things if you can go in early and discover where someone is likely to be resistant or non-responsive to the traditional non-bone marrow transplant therapy. So they found out a way of doing this. So this is what this stuff is about. They've basically worked out a way to detect in a leukemia person's blood whether they're likely to respond well or not to the standard treatment. And this is good because it means very early in the piece then you could have a look and go, actually, we should go straight to bone marrow transplant for this person. So this is quite impressive. The result of this or what can be done with this is actually quite impressive and has big implications.
Yeah, no, I could see that it could be terribly, terribly helpful.
Yeah.
Because you'd make much more informed decisions, wouldn't you, at an early stage?
Mm, and leukemia is one where if you get it right, leukemia has some really good results for me.
Yeah, it's got very good outcomes, actually, doesn't it? I mean, particularly childhood leukemia.
Especially
very,
so.
Very, I mean, treatable, yeah. Very treatable.
Similarly, I mean, I had one of my in-laws, definitely not a child, went through it, and at first they thought he was in a lot of trouble, but then when they got the thing right, completely cured, like he was actually called cured rather than just remission. And I hear this a lot nowadays.
Yeah,
being able to detect this early and very simply too, like you don't need a lot of bone marrow to check people. It's like single cell level sequencing, they call it. And then the machine learning processes and looks for patterns basically in different kinds of people and their reactions to the different treatments. So this is great.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Yeah. Fascinating. All right.
We'll keep that one.
Good stuff. We'll keep that one. Yes, that's right. All right. Rod, terrific to talk.
You too. I'll talk to you sooner or later.
Love to. Rod Lamberts has been with us, Deputy Director of the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science and co-host of the Wholesome Show podcast, where he gazes in pure delight at the whole of science. Rod, talk again.
Cheers, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.